What is our culture telling us about sex and sexuality? Is the culture pointing us and our kids to a kind of sexual flourishing that reflects God's will and way for our sexuality? And what does it mean to have a biblical understanding of sexuality? Today, we're talking to college professor and author Dale Keene about his book, Sex and the I-World, The Current Sexual Mood on Campus, How to Have Conversations with Students About Sexuality, and a whole lot more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Hey, once again, everybody, it's time for Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at CPYU, and as always, joined by Jason Sochenik, known in Spokane as the Catman.
Catman do.
That's You don't want to ask why people call you the Catman. How many cats do you have?
In Spokane or at my house?
No, at your house. Why do people call you the Catman?
I have no idea. This is the first time I've ever heard it, but please enlighten me.
Yeah,
enlighten
me. I'm just trying. I can't keep saying Jason in Spokane. I have to come up with something creative, so you're supposed to play along. Remember that next time, okay?
Okay, sure. I have 30 cats.
Yeah, there you go.
even though I actually really dislike cats, I know that that might then split our listening audience in half, but honestly, I'm just not a big cat fan, so it's interesting that you would say I'm a cat man, because we don't own any pets, and let alone a cat. We would never own a cat. We've already discussed this. This is a family value of ours.
Okay, all right. So in Spokane on the streets, would you have the same kind of dog culture that we might find elsewhere in the Northwest, like, let's say, Seattle? So when I'm up there, I see people walking dogs in outfits and suits and
very totally
humanized.
Different. No, Spokane is a lot different than Seattle.
Is that accurate? Is that an accurate picture of
Seattle? In Seattle, there's especially as you get in the more urban areas, there are dogs and cats that wear clothes, but that doesn't happen as much here in Spokane. Not as often as I've seen. Now, I would say that there are like down jackets and things that friends will place on dogs or cats, but mostly dogs. In the middle of the winter when it's snowing and it's actually very cold, it makes a lot of sense to just kind of help. But I don't know. I still have a difficult time with clothing over animals.
Yeah. I've gone here to the local, it's one of those big box pet supply stores. I don't know what the name of it is. Anyway, it's interesting to me. You know, I go in there for a box of dog biscuits, which I think is that and chew toys is what you'd find for dogs in a place like that. And it's huge. The kinds of things you can buy for dogs, it's unbelievable. The clothing. They actually have a pet hotel in there now. It's like a hotel. And you can upgrade rooms to have televisions in them and for your pets. That's interesting, This is a whole nother podcast. We'll have to...
Please. I have plenty of thoughts on this whole thing. The doggy hotels, just pet hotels.
See where,
totally get me.
And this whole thing started by me just fibbing about coming up with something about you being the cat man because I could think of nothing else.
Well,
we're going to have a great podcast today. Let's shift gears away from animals to human beings. We're going to have a great conversation a little later on with Dale Keene. Dale's an author. He's written a book called Sex in the I-World. So we're going to talk a little bit about what Dale's learned about sexuality in our culture and some of the changing trends related to that and how to begin to have an influence that gives honor and glory to God in the midst of that. But before we do that, and before we talk about youth culture, we've got this shtick down perfectly now, don't we, Jason? We turn it over. We lose control is what we do here. We turn it over to these guys, to Chris and Kenton, and they come up with a quiz or a question or something. They're smirking again.
The producers are always in control.
The producers. That's what, I think of you as engineers. But the producers, that's a little more artsy.
I like engineer.
You like engineer?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Either way, we lose control here in the moment. So.
Right. Well, what do you got?
All right. So we got a question for you.
All right, it's Kenton.
Which at some point we do want to get a quiz going, but question for now.
Okay.
If you had to drop one holiday out of the calendar, which would it be?
Easy. Halloween.
And why is that?
It drives me nuts. this seems like such the Christian answer, but honestly, I just feel like it's most often filled with pure evil. I know that a lot of people enjoy being scared by ghosts and individuals addressed as devils. And I mean, I get the idea behind it, but honestly, it's just gotten to such a place that I see houses more decorated for Halloween than I do for the Christmas holiday. And I just feel like when you start having a holiday like that, like I had to, this is the first year that I actually had to have conversations with my son about skeletons and devils and Satan and all these different aspects that a three-year-old, I just don't think I asked as a three-year-old even around Halloween, because it was not as big of a holiday, and it's just become this huge holiday. I think it's actually number two behind Christmas, if not behind Valentine's Day. And I just feel, I don't know, for a holiday that really is more about celebrating the dress up, being someone who we're not. I mean, I think it just fits into our culture.
Well, what's
in so
wrong
many
with
ways.
That? I mean, that's what we do on social media every day, right?
I know, and I think that's why I think it's getting bigger and bigger and more out of control. And and it's not just the dressing up and the ghosts and all these other things. I just think it's just inviting so many other aspects around identity, around I don't know. I feel like I'm talking like an old man, but
one word.
It is the holiday that I would choose to.
Okay. Yeah.
Ourselves
you know,
of.
And I get that, and I honor that. I'm with you there on that decoration thing, because every year Lisa and I will be out driving somewhere and we pass a house that's just like lit up, overdone, and you're going, where did that come from? And what in the world are these people? You know, and now that I have grandkids, you know, like we drove up the street back, you know, when we had Halloween here last, we drove up the street and these people had created this pretty realistic looking witch that was leaning up against a mailbox post. And we have another neighbor who took one of those like life-size skeletons and it's sitting on top of the mailbox post. And I'm just saying, if I took my three-year-old grandkids, the twins, out for a walk, this would just freak them out. You know, we just couldn't take them out. It would just terrify them.
I mean, here's the thing. I totally understand where you're coming from, because right after Halloween and even leading up to it, my son started having, I wouldn't say they were nightmares, but he was really scared to go to sleep. So these were conversations that started to take place that I would not have had to take or have be a part of our conversations had it not been for Halloween or the decorations or anything else. But I want to say this one thing. Here's the one thing I do love about Halloween, is that it brings my neighbors out, and I, for maybe the only time in the year, except for maybe parts of the summer, I get to see them. It's a community coming and walking around and coming together, and so I've just said from now on, I want this to be a holiday where we try to find ways to serve our neighbors, to get to know them better. And I think there's some great opportunities. I'm just now starting to think through what that looks like. But I just figure let's find a way to make this an enjoyable holiday.
How many kids came to your house this last
year?
So
this last year we actually spent it down in Arizona. And so I was amazed at how many. I mean, Arizona, Spokane, the end of fall, two separate things. Arizona, they're out and about and it's 70 degrees. In Spokane, it's in the 30s and 40s. But in our neighborhood in years past, we have a good number of individuals. So probably through our house, I guess I have to go buy like large bags of candy, and we get through like a bag and a half. It's not as much as it used to be, though. I would say that it used to be a lot more.
Yeah. We had between 200 and 300, and I'm with you. You know, this is the one time of year when, you know, the neighbors are out and about, so we try to use it for that. But I get the concerns, too. You know, I lived in a place I won't, but I lived in a place where it was crazy at Halloween. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, Halloween. And what was the holiday that you would choose?
Well, I immediately thought of Halloween, but you stole it. So then
so you can't. Well, you left
me with
that.
Yeah. I mean, you left me with holidays that honor certain people. So I'm not going to say no to any of those. Then I have Christmas and Thanksgiving. How can I say I don't want either of those? But I'll tell you what. Here's the holiday I complain about the most, because I don't understand why people do what they do with it and what it means to them, and that is New Year's. I don't get the craziness the night before and saying, suddenly I've turned a corner and I'm going to say to all the bad things, goodbye to all the bad things that have happened in my life, and this year is going to be great. Because here's what happens. I'm 60 years old. For 60 years, people say that every year, which basically means that the year they were looking forward to never really worked out the way it should have. So we keep hoping against hope that it's going to be better. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's a spiritual element to that, because they're hoping against hope that this is the year that I'm redeemed, but they're looking in all the wrong places to find redemption and satisfaction and fulfillment.
Yeah. So,
you know, and, you know, you got
to. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think just so much involved with it is, yeah. I haven't welcomed in the new year for about 10 or 15 years, because we're usually in bed at 10 o'clock.
Well, the great thing being on the West Coast is you can welcome in the New Year by watching the 3 hour ahead.
In Times Square.
Yeah, yeah, in Times Square. So we get to see Times Square, the dropping of the ball at 9:30 or 9, and we can go right to bed if we wanted. Huh. I have several friends that do that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would say, I'll say New Year's. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
You guys have a holiday you don't like? Chris?
I would drop Valentine's Day in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, and you're married, so this is going to – all right.
And my wife wouldn't have any concern with me saying that. She'd probably be right there with me.
Okay. And that was – was that invented by the card companies? Probably was.
I think it's definitely grown because of the card companies.
Oh, my word. And they keep inventing new holidays, too. You know, everybody's got a holiday now. It's crazy.
There's actually two National Donut Days, which please do not remove those from the calendar.
Okay.
I always miss those.
Is that when you get
just make every day a National Donut Day.
Is that when you get your peanut donuts?
Oh.
All right, don't start. Sorry, I shouldn't have brought that up. Just stop right there. We've had that conversation. This podcast will go forever. Chris is not opinionated. So,
nope.
No.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
CJ Raisin is tired of hearing about
my word.
Your peanut donuts.
They have talked about donuts so many times.
I know.
Kenton, what's yours?
You both stole mine. I was going to go either Halloween or Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
My reasoning for Valentine's Day is it kind of removes the special surprise element of it, because it's like you're this expectation of, oh, you have to do something here. It's like, well, what if I want to do something the next day and do it nice?
Yeah. Sometime you guys got to get Lisa in here and ask her about the best Valentine's gift she ever got from me. We'll do that.
Got from you? Is that?
Yeah. I really messed up one time, but it was pretty funny. And hear her tell the story.
Only one time? Only one time.
Well, that's the only time I can remember. I'm sure she remembers more.
It's the one time you actually got her something and you
messed up. No, I did. I got her something. And you know what? In the moment, I thought it was brilliant because it was something that she liked. But it wasn't. Well, we got people's interest picked now, don't we?
I'm sure people are listening and have their own opinions of what would be the holiday that they would love to most get rid of.
Send in your answers, podcast at cuiu.org. Let us know what holidays you would drop.
Yeah, and what do you think I gave Lisa? There you go. That'd be a good contest, huh?
There we go.
Podcast at cpyu.org.
If somebody guesses it correctly, we'll send them a free book.
Not only a free book, I'll get them what I got Lisa. That would be perfect.
Ooh.
Yeah. And people would like it. I'm serious. It just wasn't the
best.
A
week without Walt?
No, no, no. That's not what it was. It was a month.
It was a month.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, that's all right. Wow. Can't wait for the next podcast and what you guys come up with. Are we going to have a quiz next time? You can't promise that? Was it a quiz? Or?
I don't think it'll be next episode, but pretty
soon. Okay, we will have a quiz.
Very soon we'll be having a quiz come up.
Okay.
Okay, obviously they haven't been working on it. That's how they weasel out of that. But let's talk about youth culture and trends and things that are happening that we need to be aware of. Jason, what do you have?
Let's do. Yes, so our infamous two-minute drill. So I want to start with just an article that I had read, and I'm actually in the middle of doing some research because I want to write a blog post on this, but it came out of the Salt Lake Tribune. It was talking about how without good sex education, specifically in Utah, many of their youth were turning to porn to get answers. And Google could also be the other place where students get information. And I just thought, although the article itself, which you'll see in the list of resources, is one that I don't necessarily agree with the end result of what they're hoping to do, I do believe that we need to have better sex education, good biblical sex education in the churches. And I think in the schools, we need to have a unified way to be able to speak about this. What I find so often is that we don't have a good structure for conversations around sex. It either gets missed or it doesn't really get discussed in its fullness. And I really believe that in order for us to have a generation that's not turning to porn or Google for answers on sex, we as adults, we as educators, we as youth pastors, as pastors, need to be able to be educated ourselves so that we can educate our students. And I just really believe that we're coming into a space where we now have governments like Utah that are saying that porn is a health crisis. And so because it's a health crisis, because we're finally admitting the impact, the negative impact that it's having on our souls, on our habits, on the way that we view one another, I actually think this is a great time for us to start analyzing and looking at how are we conducting education around sex and sexuality in our homes, in our churches, because I think that there's great opportunity right now for us to be able to establish some really good conversations.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing is to realize kids have questions. That's part of who they are. That's part of how God made us. But they're having them, and they're asking them at younger and younger ages because of what they're seeing and hearing. And unfortunately, pornography is what's leading the way on a lot of that. So parents, monitor your kids. Know where they're learning and what they're learning. I got a real quick trend here that I just want to encourage parents to be aware of. You know, you may think if your kids are younger that it's going to be forever until your kids go off to the next phase of life after high school. Many of them will go off to college. I know that landscape is changing quite a bit because of the costs of higher education and the realities of student loans. We're hearing a lot about graduates who are carrying so much debt. But one of the problems is that maybe we haven't prepared our kids for college and taking loans in terms of teaching them how to use that money correctly, because about a half of students, research is showing, are blowing some of their school loan money on non-educational expenses. 3% spent loan money on alcohol and drugs. 3% used loan money to pay for vacations. 13% of college students have used loan money to eat at restaurants, 15% have used it to buy clothing, and 19% have used their loan money for car payments or other expenses related to automobiles. The greatest share, however, 41% of students spent their loan money on monthly bills, including, maybe more than anything else, their phone bills, their mobile phone bills, their smartphone bills. So, again, you know, we have to teach principles of good stewardship, and the reality is that with kids, more and more kids going into deeper debt, we need to teach them how to be good stewards of this. And in a world full of materialism and entitlement, we need to teach kids and adults to back off on spending and spend wisely.
Yeah, that's good. I came across that article, and I think the point that it made within it was, if you live like a lawyer when you're in school, if you think that you're going to be a lawyer later in life and you begin to live like a lawyer while you're in school, that doesn't build good stewardship habits. And I think that if you were to able to live as a student in school, and then you continue to do it as a lawyer, think about the money you're able to spend and the good that you can do with it for the kingdom.
Hey, the wise thing is teach kids to live like they run a nonprofit.
That's exactly right. That is exactly
or
right.
Or work for a nonprofit.
We should have our own workshop on that.
Yeah.
Well, changing the corner just a little, or turning the corner just a little bit, one of the things that articles that I came across was Time's 30 Most Influential Teens of 2016. And I just say this for parents and for youth workers, church leaders, anyone listening to the podcast, I would go and check out this list. And I think the reason it's important to check out this list is because these individuals, these teens, are the individuals that are having an influence on our sons and daughters. They are individuals that have a voice. These are the individuals that are creating the soup in which they live. And so we need to be able to watch, listen, be aware, because it provides opportunity for conversation and it provides opportunity for us to go deeper, to really take what's being said and then dive into deeper conversation with our sons and daughters. Two that I would point out that we've had conversations on our podcast in the past about, but I think that it's just important to be aware of. One is Kylie Jenner, which is the daughter of Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner's daughter. And she is noted in this as someone that's changing the way that we think about beauty. But as you and I both know, she's also started some viral campaigns that have led to the plump lips, the dyeing of hair. She's also looked at the bright makeup combinations. These are things that our sons, our daughters, but even some of our sons are mimicking, and we have to be aware of that. And that's something we'll probably even talk about in the next story. The other one is Lori Hernandez, because just with every Kylie Jenner, there's also Lori Hernandez, who was an Olympic gold medalist. And the story that she tells and the influence that she can have is one that's really positive. And so I think that as we have some of these different stories, just being aware of who these people are and being able to point to the things that, yes, that's something that's good, and allow for it to then be conversations that take place in our home that model what we want to be able to impart on our sons and our daughters.
Mm. Yeah, you gave me a good segue there, because one of the big stories of the fall, and hopefully people caught it because I think it is really significant, is that CoverGirl is now having a cover boy. So CoverGirl, which traditionally would use female models from their inception till now has a cover boy. He's 17-year-old James Charles. He's from Bethlehem, New York, and he became an internet sensation through YouTube and Instagram, where when he would post these tutorials on how to do makeup. And they're, I've watched a couple of them, and I can see why kids who have an interest in this would be drawn in, but there's much more going on there as well in terms of his own understanding of himself and gender and sexuality and that sort of thing. I mean, roles are changing. And I think that what we need to be aware of here are several trends coming together, sort of a perfect storm, as if you would, that's happening in terms of this particular trend and story. One would be gender. That gender is very fluid right now. It's very, some would say, very liquid. And what we need to do is, from a young age, come to an understanding of what the biblical teaching on gender is, and then teach that to our kids. I think another trend that you're seeing in the midst of this, or another thread in this, or beauty standards, as you've mentioned as well, with the most influential teens of 2016, that Time list, so much of it is about outward appearance, that your whole identity is wrapped up in that. And that does influence our girls in terms of how they present and curate, fabricate themselves, and then also our boys in terms of what they value. And then lastly, the whole phenomena of internet celebrity, that somehow if James Charles can do it, what can I do? How can I put myself out there on YouTube and Instagram to get all the following and the followers and the big following and all the likes? And that seems to be what so many young kids are aspiring to now. So just keep an eye on those strains and that trend.
Yeah. Well, the last story that I just want to point out, or it's really a trend that we see happening, and I've seen this happen from the time that I served as a youth worker till even now, still doing youth work in a different capacity, is this dynamic of middle-class teens stealing, specifically middle-class females who have taken on this aspect of stealing, not because they need to, but because it's a part of the process of going through adolescence for some of them. It's a place of identity. It's an opportunity to be part of a tribal experience, if you will, where they're able to be accepted into this crowd, and it's just a rite of passage. And we've talked some about the idea of rites of passage being missed in our
right,
adolescent
in our culture,
years.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this in some ways has become a rite of passage. And so I think the thing that stands out to me in this is we can sometimes assume, and I see this happening in so many different circles, that the individuals before us are these really good, they can do no wrong, but assumption it doesn't do any good unless we really know who we're working with. And I just think that this is an opportunity. I use this article because I think of how many times I assume something that just wasn't true. And we don't really know someone until we really start to talk to them, engage them on their level, get to know who they are, what they love, what they dislike. I think we need to be good students of the students in our youth in our youth ministry and in our own home, of our sons and our daughters. This article just really reminded me of the fact that, you know what? What is it that we most want? We want to be known. We want to be loved. And sometimes when you're going through adolescence, you don't make the smartest of choices because you just want to have a place of acceptance. You want to be known. You want to be loved. And sometimes it's around the circle of friends that aren't necessarily making the wisest of choices. Yeah. So I just use this as an opportunity for us to be aware. We need to be students of our kids. We need to be students of the students that are in our youth ministry and in our home, because I think that opportunity allows for us to then have some deeper, more meaningful conversations about who they are.
You know, Jason, and one of the takeaways from this is that when we have conversations with kids who make immoral choices or illegal choices or immoral/illegal choices, which we know shoplifting is, rather than right out of the gate saying you shouldn't do that, because chances are they know that. I know there's some kids who don't. But one of the questions we need to ask as we talk about knowing our students is we need to say, why did you do that? Yeah. And there are numerous reasons for that, and that helps us get at the heart of kids. Well, last trend that I'm going to share with you here, and this is, again, related to the university, the college campus, and it relates to the whole notion of drug and alcohol abuse, which unfortunately is a huge part of the adolescent experience and perhaps an even bigger part of the college experience and what people expect. But the pressure to drink when you're on campus is so big that when you combine that with appearance pressure, you have what's called drunkorexia. They're actually calling it that, this new habit that's appearing on the college campus where students are looking to abuse alcohol and get drunk, but they're looking to avoid the weight gain that's normally associated with consuming alcohol. Or maybe they're just trying to get a faster buzz. So what they're doing is they skip meals, they exercise heavily before drinking alcohol, they take laxatives or diuretics, or they vomit after they imbibe, after they have an alcoholic intake. And this is a disturbing trend that's on the rise. They are studying this. The Research Society on Alcoholism, yes, there is such a thing because there has to be, is saying that this actually straddles the line, drunkorexia does, between an alcohol disorder and an eating disorder. And what we need to do is monitor our students, really derail the movement towards this by providing them with a lot of preventive education, speaking to them about what's good, true, right, and honorable, and the kinds of places to pursue, things to pursue, kinds of places to avoid when they get to the college campus. So just be aware of that drunkorexia. Speaking of the college campus, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk to Dale Keen. Dale's a writer, written a book called Sex in the I World. That's what we'll be talking about. But he spends a lot of time with college students because he's actually a college professor at St. Anselm in New Hampshire. So stick with us, and when we come back, we're going to have a great conversation, an enlightening conversation with Dale Keen. Here at CPYU, we're taking steps to help parents, youth workers, educators, and anyone else who cares about kids help the kids they know and love navigate the difficult issues of life. We've put together a one-day training seminar called Tackling the Tough Stuff that we can bring to your community. Over the course of the day, Mark Penner and I will provide information and practical steps you can take to address narcissism, pornography, self-injury, depression, suicide, and a variety of other tough issues kids face in today's world. To learn more about bringing Tackling the Tough Stuff to your church or community, go to cpyu.org/toughstuff or call us at 1-800-807-CPYU.
Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. I'm here with Walt and Dale Keen, who recently wrote a book called Sex in the iWorld. It's a book that, Walt, we use often in our ministry at Project 619. And so I'm really excited to be able to have Dale here with us to be able to dive into some conversation. But before we do so, Dale, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Youth Culture Matters. We're glad to have you here.
Oh, and I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself. You're a professor. You've written this book. So I would love for them to just get to know you before we dive into some of this conversation.
Sure. I've been teaching politics at St. Anselm College here in Manchester, New Hampshire since 1994. And one of the unique things about politics in New Hampshire is the New Hampshire primary. So we've had an experience here where all the candidates come to our campus multiple times, host nationally televised debates. And so over the last 22 years, I've gotten not only a front row seat on American politics, but also had an opportunity to engage with candidates in the media, et cetera. And it's out of a lot of those conversations that this book comes, actually.
Wow. Well, I mean, let's dive right into this conversation and hear a little bit about this book, because the book, Sex in the iWorld, for me and for our ministry, it was really profound. I thought that you brought about a lot of great points that I think our listeners would really love to hear. But before we dive into that, I would love to hear from you how the book even came to be.
Sure. I'm, in addition to being a politics professor full-time, I'm also an ordained minister. And as I got to know members of the media and the campaigns, et cetera, they would know that I'm both a politics professor. They'd pick up that I was a minister. Over the years, some people would call me Father Dale or Rabbi Dale, depending on where they were coming from. But I'd often get invited to be a talking head with the media on questions related to religion and politics. And so in that capacity, I did a lot of that kind of, had a lot of those conversations. I did some writing in the area. And then gradually what began to emerge are questions about same-sex marriage. And it first cropped up in Massachusetts, which is right to our south. Massachusetts Supreme Court decided one day there was a right to same-sex marriage in the Massachusetts Constitution. And the press was at my door wanting to know what I thought. And what I thought was that I'm not from Massachusetts and I don't want to talk about it, because I know the issues of sexuality and politics are lethal. They can end conversations. They can end careers. And it wasn't an area I wanted to go into. But it didn't stop there. The Episcopal Church in New Hampshire decided to ordain Eugene Robinson, who was the first openly gay bishop in the worldwide Anglican Communion, and his ordination has touched off the firestorm in that particular denomination. So again, the press was at my door wanting to know what I thought about it, and really what I said was, I'm not Episcopalian and I don't want to talk about it. But it created within me kind of a crisis of faith, and that is that if I'm not willing to talk about the most important issues of the day, I can certainly be a politics professor and say no comment, but as a pastor, I didn't feel like I could. So I decided that I needed to either give up my ordination or decide to try to address it. One day I had an opportunity to be with Bishop Robinson on a debate on New Hampshire Public Radio, and the gist of the whole thing was that I got clobbered. And part of the reason, speaking frankly, that I got clobbered was that I realized in the middle of the thing I didn't have the language to speak to the world what I believed to be true, which is Christian teaching about sexuality is good news. And the world had changed so profoundly since I was in graduate school and in seminary that I just didn't have the language to speak to the age in which we live. So I went away Wow. for 5 years, worked on this book, and decided I wasn't going to publish it till I was first persuaded that I thought the scripture was good news on this. And then second of all, I had language that I could speak to people about it. So that's kind of the journey that brought me to here.
Let me just interrupt right there, because your story, Dale, is fascinating to me. And the fact that you have, well, let me say it this way. Just the self-awareness to be able to say, I got clobbered. I mean, those are strong words, all right? And you're admitting that, and you allowed that to change the trajectory of how you were thinking about things, or at least the process you would take.
Yeah.
I find that in our world, well, the church world at large, and even in the world of youth ministry and parenting, we make a lot of broad pronouncements on the issues of the day without really thinking through the issues of the day and how to best address those issues of the day. And, you know, we wind up with egg on our face. We get clobbered. We get clobbered by our own kids. We get clobbered by the kids in our youth group. And just if you would just pause there for a moment, because I think this is an important discussion to have. How can we as parents, do you have any good advice for us as parents and youth workers, those of us who, grandparents, who you're two generations removed from kids, you probably get doubly clobbered in some of these conversations. You know, how do we listen to the world? What posture do we need to take? I'll just leave it at that. There's about 1,000 sub-questions I could ask to that, but
I mean, for myself, the way that I deal with it is I kind of have to have a little bit of a gut check. If I believe that the scripture is saying something that's true about the human condition, then I need to figure out what's the most honest way to communicate it. And by honest, I'm not going to try to change it. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it, etc. But at the same time, the ways in which we communicated what we believe to be true back in my childhood, the 60s and the 70s, the way we were taught to communicate these things when I was in seminary in the 80s, the world has a different mindset today. And the question that I have to ask myself is it the case that the scripture speaks the truth to every generation at every time in history? And even if it's not good news, even if it's not necessarily the news that people want to hear, the question is, in a certain way, is the trajectory that culture is presently on going to work? And I think what we all realize the longer we live is that we make certain assumptions about life, about what's going to work, and we discover over time that certain assumptions we had, certain assumptions our culture had, just plain didn't work. And are there voices that spoke to us that call us to something, call us, each one of us, to reconsider something when we're at a time in our life to reconsider? So when I go speak to people about this issue, I'm not under either the illusion or the pressure that I'm going to change a lot of minds at the moment. But what I hope to do is communicate things in such a way that people can draw on them if they come to the conclusion that the trajectory that they're on, the culture is on, won't work. And I've got to get it out of my head that people have to understand things the way I understand them, or had came to understand them, because it's a different moment.
Yeah. I like the way you say there, I'm not under the illusion or the pressure, which...
Yeah.
Boy, that is significant. So I just scribbled that down. I think that's significant in terms of our posture. And really, you know, we often say here, you can't, for a student, you can't, a young person, and you know this with college students, you can't drag a college student, a young person screaming and kicking, anybody for that matter, into God's kingdom and into our way of thinking. We can only communicate the truth in terms that they can understand without compromising what's true, and then trust God's Spirit. So that is great practical advice. I really like that. Thanks for that little sidetrack with me there.
Sure. Well, that actually, I think, works really well, because, Dale, you mentioned something in a... when we last met, you were getting ready to speak at a Q event, And I remember at one of the Q events that you spoke about the opportunity we have as Christians, that this is a time in which we have, because you were talking about worldview, you were talking about some of our mindsets today being different. And you had said something that has always stuck with me, and it's the fact that this might be the greatest opportunity we have as Christians to evangelize. Sure. And I would love for you to dive into that a little bit and share some of your thoughts. I know that some of those, many of those came out of the book, and even goes back to sexuality being good news. So right. Yeah, could you dive into a little bit of that frame of mind?
Yeah. I mean, we live in a moment now which I kind of characterize as the I world, which is kind of a world of extreme or excessive individualism. The belief is that if each one of us individually can end up living the life that we either want to live or feel like we must live, we're going to find fulfillment and happiness. And I'm of the persuasion that that's actually a dead end. I don't think it'll work. And so I think that both... there's going to be a lot of individuals are going to wake up one day and say, this trajectory of trying to please myself didn't work. I think our society is going to wake up and say, not only didn't it work for personal fulfillment, it didn't work economically. We're broke. Pursuing our own economic advantage at the moment is bankrupting our future. And I think people are going to say, okay, if this doesn't work, what does work? And I think Christians need to take the long view. I think we need to recognize that there's going to be time when it's time for us, perhaps like Isaiah, if we're fortunate, in the sense that we're actually accurate and we don't fudge things. But times like Isaiah, where you're able to stand up and testify to a future that's hopeful, that there's a way forward. And that when those moments come where the culture is asking those questions, we have credibility. I find that a lot of Christians right now either tend to want to go backwards in time and recapture a time in the past that no longer exists, or I find other Christians that want to accommodate to the kind of the present moment. And I think we need to recognize that we're at our best when we're a countercultural movement, but a countercultural movement that's forward-looking. I think that it's truly the case that we're going to find that sexuality does not make us happier. I think we're going to find that trying to find the ideal person to be with is not the thing that's going to make us happier. But learning how to love other people well, learning to have boundaries around our sexuality, learning to think about our life and the quality of our life in terms not of standard of living economically, but the quality of our relational lives. I think all of that is true. And so I think it's not, I mean, I hate to put it in political terms, like we quote, have a winning message, but I believe in the deepest of my being that Christianity, Jesus, speaks to us in a winsome way. And what I am called to do is I'm called to try to translate it without changing it. For the moment in which we live. And I just say that, you know, if you look at junior high kids, middle school kids coming up, they already recognize that sexual freedom is not bringing the happiness. And so they're beginning to explore different things. So while the adults are continue to be obsessed with issues of sexual identity and freedom, young people are getting more discerning, and they recognize that's not working. I don't know that they've found what does work, but it's probably incumbent on the adults in the room to admit that the trajectory we're on isn't working.
Are you seeing and hearing that in your students there at St. Anselm? Are you?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. How do they express that?
I'm finding that while intellectually they have the freedom to be in multiple sexual relationships without being judged, I find that there's less promiscuity going on, and it's not because they've bought into an abstinence message or a Christian message, but there's been studies done on both coasts, San Francisco, New York, etc., that shows that high school kids are having less sex now than they did 5 years ago. And I think part of it is due to they've been exposed to a lot of hardcore pornography from a young age. They've had the permission to experiment from a young age, and they found it wanting. And so they're exploring other avenues to fulfillment and not the sexuality piece. So what I find ironic is you've got, quote, the adults who think they're giving the kids this great world of sexual freedom and identity and all these kind of freedoms, but the kids are already saying we're not so sure that that's the world we want. But the adults are so excited about it and pleased with themselves, they really aren't listening.
Yeah. I see that. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I see that as good news in the sense that, you know, seeing sex as redemptive, is, you know, that's going to fall through the cracks there. But then, you know, obviously the option to present the gospel or to find the Redeemer, to come into a relationship with the Redeemer. But, you know, our history and our personal lives typically just move from one false Redeemer to another. So you were talking about, you know, this is not an, they're not seeing as an avenue to freedom. Are you seeing them move to other quote unquote avenues of freedom? Has that panned out yet? Are you able to see where that's going? Because those are the kinds of things we're interested in hearing about and passing on to people, because that's what we have to, as parents and youth workers, really address.
Yeah.
Anything you've seen?
I'm thinking about it. I would find, I don't want to paint the generation that I work with. I don't want to paint them as cynical. I don't want to paint them as self-absorbed, because I don't see it that way. But what I would say is that there's less optimism among that generation in terms of how much, quote, happiness or wealth that they will accumulate. If the American dream is that our children are going to be wealthier than our parents, I think millennials recognize that they're not going to be, that the debt they're getting from either college or from their parents through the government is something they're probably not going to be able to climb out from under. So I don't think of that. They don't seem to be as materialistic as past generations, because I think they've lost hope in that. I think that they are more reluctant to enter into long-term relationship. Again, it's not because they wouldn't like it, but they're not so sure it'll work. I think they're less optimistic about, you know, sexual freedom bringing them fulfillment. And so I find them to be a group of people that like to hang out with each other. I find them to be a group of people that want to take care of people that are down and out. But I also sense that they're not a group that has a lot of optimism for themselves or the future. Maybe they've lowered their sights or, in a certain sense, cut themselves off. And so I think it's a moment at which we as Christians can speak into this, but we're going to need to recognize that our audience is not looking for a quick fix. Our audience is skeptical about anything working. And so, again, trying to be honest and authentic and hopeful matters. And I think the gospel speaks to this. Mm-hmm. So I think this generation, if it finds Jesus, can be absolutely unleashed, but they're not going to buy into an unreal Jesus.
Well, I want to pick up on that. We're going to take a quick break, but I want to pick up on some of what we're talking about right here, because I think there's a lot, and I think you address some of this well in your book. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Dale Keene. Thanks for listening.
Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators.
Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. Again, we're here with Dale Keene, and Walt and I love to do this thing, Dale, called Take Five. It's an opportunity for our listeners and for us to get to know you a little bit better. So we're going to ask you some questions, and it's in Walt's hands, so we never quite know where it's going to go when Walt's asking the questions, but this will be a lot of fun. We typically learn new things, and maybe you'll even learn something new about yourself in this process. So,
How does that happen? So, Walt, that we learn new things about ourselves when I ask questions? And it always moves in a good direction. I have no clue, Dale, what he's talking about. All right, you ready? Now, these are just get to know you. It's fun. Have fun with this. All right. First question, number one. Your favorite pop song from your high school years?
My favorite pop song from
Yeah, song you loved when you were in high school. A soundtrack to your high school years. What was it?
A soundtrack to my high school years would be Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who.
Oh, okay. Boy, that's a good one. Now it's going to be stuck in your head for the rest of the day, so just prepare for that.
For all my life. Yeah.
In the last year, what is the best book that you've read? We love book recommendations, trying to get people to read. So give us a good book.
The best book I've read in the last year is Consolations of Philosophy by Alain de Botton, who's a French thinker. And he, in a very accessible way, speaks about different philosophers and how they connect with our everyday lives.
Okay. Well, you know what? Yeah. When you initially said that, I thought, well, I don't know that many of our listeners will pick that up and read it, but we're going to link to it. And if it's as accessible, and part of what we're trying to do is get people to read things that they might not have otherwise heard about that would be good. All right. All right. Here's a great question. I was so excited about this one. Now, you and I went to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary together, 1982 to 85. What was your favorite memory of me?
I have no memory of you.
That's what I figured. All right, so let's move on to number four.
I have no memory.
I know. I know. Survive. And I'm going, as I said, I'm going to go back home after we record this, and I'm getting out that Facebook we got. And you and I, we both need to do that. Because I got a hunch we're going to see people that we go, oh, yeah. It's like going to your high school reunion. You know, you're probably looking at me going, all right, you're in there, but I'm not sure where. You know, the shell just changes. Now, that's not commentary on you.
Typically with when you go back and look at old memories, you also look 20 pounds younger. So,
yeah.
You know what, I mean, Jason, that didn't need to be said.
I'm old enough to know that now. As I go back and look at our high school reunions, I think, wow, you don't look the same.
All right, here we go. Number four. If you could play any role on a popular TV show, what character would it be? I'm assuming you watch TV. I know you read philosophy books. So.
I would probably love to be Watson and Sherlock.
Okay. All right.
Oh,
well,
wow.
See, now we're getting to know what kind of human being you are. That's great. Now, this is our last question, number five. This is a big one. And I honestly think so much of the future of our world hinges on this question. Don't worry. It's not about politics. New England lobster or Maryland crab?
New England lobster.
I knew it. I love that. I'm with you. You're right there, right? You can. How far
right
are you?
There.
How far are you from the water?
We're 40 miles from the water.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, that's good. All right, good. Thanks for playing along. And we're just going to edit out question number three.
Sounds good.
No, that's great. Or he'll edit in his own answer. So
yeah, well, I'll have to work on my impersonation. Yeah. You changed my life in seminary. That
all
was
right.
Awesome.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for participating in the Take Five. That was great. Well, circling back around to the conversation we had right before the last break and specifically talking about some of the differences between generations, one of the things that I've had conversation with you in the past about is, and even some of the work that you do, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, when it comes to conversations about three-generational families. And I would love for those that are listening to hear some of that and hear the importance of some of the conversations that you're bringing up with regards to three-generational families.
Sure. I mean, I think in the United States, just the very conversation about three-generational families makes people think of of old. I think fewer and fewer people have an imagination to comprehend how significant that was. And I would say that there's virtually no pressure in public policy and politics to do things to bring that back. Here in the United States and other parts of the world, however, governments that we'd regard as very forward-looking are actually trying to do things to re-energize it. And the issue is primarily economic, not moral. We often talk about the social cost of children being born outside of marriage or outside of a stable family situation. And, I mean, economists can tell us with, you know, with reasonable accuracy what the extra cost of society will be when that happens for a child. But that's small money in comparison to taking care of the elderly. And what societies, what people are discovering is that if children are not taken care of by their biological parents when they're kids, the children don't take care of their biological parents when their parents are elderly. And since over 40% of our kids in the United States are born outside of marriage, in places like Australia and Europe, it's often up to 60%. What governments are realizing is that there's kind of a ticking economic time bomb with the aging population, because if children aren't going to take care of their parents, which is a bargain, the cost for governments to take care of them is literally unaffordable. And so other countries are beginning to do things to, what can we do to keep families together? What can we do to keep parents connected to their kids, even if we can't save their marriage? And then what can we do to get children to take care of the elderly? The German High Court recently ruled that a man who didn't take care of his father had to pay the German government 8,000 euros a year to compensate them for that. And it's not, again, because the German government developed this conservative moral approach to things, but they recognize the economic cost. And the United States, we will get there soon, as soon as the rest of the world stops buying our debt. And what economists are realizing now is that we can't afford to live in a world without the generations connected to each other in a pretty deep way. So it's not a question of the Bible says this, we ought to do it, or if we please God, we ought to do this. The point is, we don't see how we can have a viable society if this is not done, first of all, economically. So there's a lot of conversations going on in countries around the world on these questions of marriage, family, connecting the generations. And it'll come to us soon.
So you say soon. What would need to change for it to come to us sooner?
I think once foreign countries stop buying our debt and we have to finance our debt, it's going to happen. We have known for quite a while that ever since Social Security was established, we never put aside money to pay for it as a country. Beginning in 2018 will be the first year that we pay out more than we take in for Social Security. And in a very contentious political campaign, I don't believe that either Trump or Clinton have mentioned that. But everybody in Washington knows that it's coming. So we have some significant indebtedness in our country. We have almost a $20 trillion national debt. And the pressures on that are going to begin to rise pretty fast beginning next year. Again, I think we have a nation of people that don't want to look at it. We're petrified of it. We're afraid of losing our standard of living. But I think millennials know that the standard of living argument is basically not part of our future. And that's why I think it's incumbent upon us to say with confidence that the quality of life, quality of our relationships was always more important than how much money we had. And we might be afraid of losing our standard of living, but I think as Christians, we're recovering our home territory to say, no, it's always been about quality of life and quality of relationships.
So this again then is a great opportunity for us, you know, a moment in time and in our culture to, I mean, the gospel speaks to this. And as you describe this, it actually gives me shivers a little bit, because it's very hopeful in the sense that the more we see our emptiness, or the more the culture sees an issue, if we have something to say to it, that's a great way to be salt and light.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've become increasingly persuaded that, and I should have had this all along, but I've become increasingly persuaded that God designed the world in such a way that if we don't live the way we're supposed to, there's a self-correcting mechanism. In other words, sin doesn't work, disobedience doesn't work, bad economics doesn't work. That, and just because something doesn't work doesn't mean we won't try something else that doesn't work. But I think in a certain sense, it shouldn't surprise us when we live in a way that we're not supposed to. We shouldn't surprise us that it literally doesn't work. And the good news is there is a way that does work.
Yeah, and God often brings us to the ends of ourselves to get us to that point. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, this is fascinating. This is a great discussion to have.
Well, let me. I want to continue on this road a little bit. In your book, you discuss the T world, the traditional world, which you discussed a little bit in our last part of the podcast, I world, but then the R world, and I'm assuming that some of the work that you're doing when you have some of the conversations with some of these governments includes a lot of the R world, and maybe describe what the R world is, and maybe even and correct me if I'm wrong when it comes to what you're sharing as you're diving into these conversations around generations, if this is or is not a part of that.
Sure. No, it definitely is. And what I believe is that this I world that we live in, I think it literally won't work. And I think it'll take 30 or 40 years for everybody to kind of sit back and say whether it was worth the effort or not. The thing just is falling apart. It's just falling apart because it's economically unsustainable. And I think then the question is there any hope for the future? And as I go talk to people, I think that there's a decline in hope. And what I want to say is that we do have a hope and we do have a future, and it's found in a world that's built around loving God, self, and neighbor. And I would say that the scripture from cover to cover basically said we were created to love the Lord our God with all our mind, heart, and soul. We're called to love our neighbor as ourselves. I think that every Old Testament law is connected to loving God or loving neighbor. I think Jesus is constantly reaffirming that. I think loving God and neighbor is multidimensional, so it's not just kind of the touchy-feely family thing or marriage thing, but it's literally an economic thing. It's relationships in our community. It's relationships between groups. And I think that what is it that we can do as a society to incentivize relational connections as opposed to individualism. And so, for instance, the Australian government has passed a law that says if you live more than 50 miles away from your biological child under the age of 18, you have to pay an extra $2,000 a year. And you could see it as punitive, but it's a way for them to incentivize staying in proximity with your kids. The Chinese government is moving toward requiring all high school students in China to take the Alpha Marriage course. And the reason they're doing it is because the Alpha Marriage course has been proven to work. The Chinese are aware that one of the consequences of the single child policy has been, for reasons that I could go into on another podcast, the consequences of that policy has kind of been the undermining of marriage and family. And they want to teach people the skills again to what does it mean to be married? What does it mean to be in a relationship, a lifelong relationship that takes care of generations? And they do this not because they've discovered religion in the Chinese government, but because they've figured out that the marriage course actually works, and their people are interested in what works. So what I'm trying to do is help people imagine a future. I think the crisis of our day, I think the challenge for millennials is the loss of relational hope. So while it may have been a time 10 years ago, we were concerned about getting people not to have sex outside of marriage, et cetera, et cetera. I think the bigger challenge today is answering the question, why should I have any hope for the future? Why should I have hope that I'll be in relationships for life that'll be sustaining? Why should I have hope that anybody will bother to take care of me as I grow old? Why should we hope that this is has any kind of fulfillment? And so I think it's incumbent upon us as Christians to first of all address the issue of hope and then to address how we might get there. But quite frankly, if people don't have hope, it doesn't matter how good your blueprints are. And so, you know, I've had a love-hate relationship with the church most of my life, but I've come to the conclusion that the church has an absolutely indispensable role to play in modeling to the world what healthy relationships can be, to help people get the imagination for what the future might be. And I think that modeling of behavior is maybe more important than anything we say at the moment.
I love this. And you're giving us some very practical guidelines here, which I know youth workers and parents need to hear. You've mentioned, just back up a minute, I've heard you mention a few times individualism. And yep. I know, you know, I've been reading more now about, Robert Bella talking about expressive individualism, Charles Taylor following up on that, and others who are writing about that. And I'm wondering if you could offer, just off the top of your head, I hope this is a fair question, if you could offer some practical, workable, doable suggestions to youth workers and parents beyond what you just stated in terms of offering these models to help us shatter this expressive individualism that just does so much harm to right. the very individuals who gravitate towards it and think it's going to fix things, and then also, you know, corporately and culturally.
Yeah. Well, I'll take a stab at it. And let me
interrupt you, because you just talked about your love-hate relationship with the church. Maybe you have some critique of the church in how we've promoted this as well. I'm just setting you up here if that's an option. Yeah.
I think one of the things we can do is to help people see that the present trajectory doesn't work. One example I will give. Among my college students now, the issue of sexuality and marriage is yesterday. We could certainly have a conversation about it, but it's a settled issue for them. The bigger question at the moment is the issue of identity, particularly gender identity. And the narrative of the culture at the moment is that every human being needs to look within to figure out who they are, that every human being has a unique identity. It's discovered by self-examination, etc. I think it's the philosophers and many pagan philosophers would actually dispute that pretty intensely. The argument is nobody can understand who they are without a reference point outside of themselves. And that the reality is that humans don't figure out who they are by looking within. They figure out who they are by reference points. And the question that we all have to ask ourselves is, what's the best reference point? Mm. And what I believe in the deepest part of my being is the best reference point to figure out who we are is God. And that getting connected to God, getting related to God, is better at helping us understand who we are than anything else. And I would say that the church, I think that it's not just the case that we have to talk about it, it's the case that we have to live it. If I was asked, for instance, to go do a marriage conference in the hopes of teaching millennials how to get married, I'd probably decline, because I don't think saying that marriage is good is going to carry much weight. I think what's going to have to happen is people are going to have to be involved in a community in which people are loved well, that people are cared for well, that people are connected to God, and that the love of God is embodied in that community. And with human beings, that's always imperfect, but real. And then I think once people get their relational imagination stirred, they see that people can love for life, both inside and outside marriage. I think then that we can recapture marriage as a society, etc. So I think we've got a lot to say, but I think that one of the big challenges right now is that there's a bunch of us my age, and I'm guilty as charged, who overvalue financial security, undervalue relationship, and as a result, we reflect the world more than we reflect Jesus. I think millennials, if they were to come and look at me in this, they would find very little to be appealing, since they don't think financial security is a viable way to move forward, as much as they may like it. And so it's incumbent upon all of us to get back to our roots, to understand it's about the relationships with God and each other. It's not about the sex, and it's not about the money. It's about the love. And when we can embody that, people are going to recognize that there's something better than sex, and there's something better than money. And it's not so much what we're giving up, but it's so much about what we're getting. And I say this, and it sounds trite, and it sounds cliche, but at the same time, millennials, to their credit, they want truth, authenticity, and honesty. And if we in the church don't have the confidence that it's about love and it's about loving God, self, and neighbor, they're not going to find anything around us that's appealing. But I think it's literally the only way forward. And I say that as an economic statement and as a political statement, as well as a statement of my faith. Mm.
Dale, this is good. this is just a lot to take in, but it's, I think the thing I really appreciate about what you're sharing is it's challenging us to go deeper. It's challenging us to think broader with regards to our own Christian sexual ethic. And I really appreciate the work that you've put in and the words that you're expressing. So thank you. I want to just ask one last question before we close out, and it's resources that you would recommend to our listeners to pick up with regards to some of the conversation that we've shared today.
Sure. It's a very difficult environment for academics to write in any kind of deep, meaningful way about these things because it's so politically charged. Mark Regeneros down at the University of Texas has done some great studies on sexuality and relationship among people of all ages. So I always recommend his work. There's a Polish thinker, Zygmunt Bauman, who wrote a book called Liquid Love. And, you talk about a Polish philosopher and people's eyes glaze over, but again, it's a really accessible book. But he's enormously insightful about the state of love in our society today. There's an old book, but a really good one, Denis de Rochemont, Love in the Western World, in which he basically puts forward an argument that says the narrative of love in our world is the only thing that we seem to be attracted to is the love we can't have. And so we don't have an imagination to find satisfaction in love that we can have. And it's, again, it's a really insightful book. There's a French novelist named Michel Houellebecq, who's written several novels about kind of the state of the affairs in the world today. They're rather over-the-top depressing, I'd say. I think that they're extraordinarily sexualized, so some people might not subscribe to your webcast because I even endorsed the books. But what's valuable about his books is that they are brilliant looks at a contemporary world in an unromanticized way. Mm. And find that to be really helpful, because Christians tend to think we're the crazy people, and in a certain sense we behave that way, but our faith isn't crazy. And I do believe that our God designed this world. I do believe it works in a certain way. And if anything needs to happen first, we need to recover our own confidence in God and in Scripture.
Good, good recommendations. Jason, I really appreciate you making contact with Dale and getting him on here. This is good. And I did hear him earlier talk about another podcast, you know, inviting himself back. Which is fine, because we're going to do that.
I think that would be great.
Yeah, you beat us to it, but we would do it anyway, Dale. So we're going to have you back, because these are good conversations, and I love this. We will include links to everything you mentioned. We'll get the titles for all these books and these authors. As we say to people all the time who may be listening, not on our homepage, cpyu.org, for the Youth Culture Matters page on our website, if you're listening through iTunes or some other provider streaming this, come to the page and you'll get to see all these things. And we always recommend as well that if you want to purchase this, we'll include a link to our good friend Byron Borger over at Hearts and Minds Bookstore, and he'll be able to help you out with that. All the information will be on the website for that. So any parting words there, Jason? Or
no, this has been good? Great. Yeah. Dale, thank you so much for the time that you've given us.
Well, you're welcome.
Thanks so much. And we look forward again, Dale, to having you back and to being with folks on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.